Stories go in circles. They don't go in straight lines. So it helps if you listen in circles.
There are stories inside stories, and there are stories between stories.
And finding your way through them is as easy
and as hard
as finding your way home.
And part of the finding is the getting lost.
And when you're lost, you start to look around and to listen.
You're listening to Word of Mouth, a conversation in three parts investigating America's narrative tradition. Today's program, the first in the series, asks, why do people tell stories? It includes comments and tales from Stutz Terkel, Barbara Meyerhoff, Elliot Wigginton, Joe Carson, Ray Hicks, and Jackie Torrance.
When I think of storytellers, my favorite storyteller is a man named Jay O'Callaghan. I love him.
John Henry Falk. No one tops Johnny.
Dr. Curtis Williams.
Granny Leslie.
Diane Wolkstein.
Louise Anderson.
There's a guy named Guy Trubé.
Walden Cuddy, the man down the road that runs the grocery store.
Well, my favorite storyteller is Stutz Terkel.
Imagine hearing the mayor of Buckeye Square, Charlie One-Arm, One-Armed Charlie Wendorf, telling how he lost his arm in World War I. He said, there we are, and Charlie would talk that way. He'd point the stub of a hand up. Hey, One-Armed Charlie, the mayor of Buckeye Square, he says, so when the president called me, my president, Woodrow Wilson, I'm 110% American, I gotta go, save the world for democracy, and there we are marching down Michigan Boulevard, and the streets are lined up with thousands of people. He says, and there comes the little drum majorette, you know, and you see her walk, little Fanny is twitching, and you got the band behind and the trombone player right behind the key, hard time keeping his mind on his work. And here come the open cars with all those fat cats, the generals and the colonels with the eagles and the chicken on their shoulders, and they're waving, and at the end comes us, the camels, carrying a pack of 60 pounds, and they're waving at us, the girls, the guys. We're with you, boys. We're with you all the way. Then we're on a boat, and we land at Brest in France, you know, and the order's reversed. We the camels. We're the first ones off. And we go, we look behind. There's no drum majorette, no trombone player, no cats in the big open cars. And way, way, we hear the crowds. We're with you, boys. Far, far away. And then finally, I wind up at Château-Thierry. I'm shot. I'm on a trench. And I holler, Brandy! 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 And a YMCA guy comes over giving me a canteen of water. I don't want this. I want some brandy or some rum. And here I am saved thanks to Demon Rum. Hey, you want to know something? I got this one arm. If I had two arms, I'd be nothing. But you know me as One-Armed Charlie Wendorf. You know what this other one is? This other one is somewhere in the province of Cognac in Paris, in France, rather. And he's down there, and that's nurturing the grapes that give you big shots who come true here. Couvreur, give you Remy Martin, give you Tristar Hennessy. That's what I said. That's where I am. One arm Charlie Wendorf. Now, there's a story, you see. He went over
there. Storytellers are spellcasters.
It's like giving somebody the gift of images.
It started in the mountains to entertain with.
People tell stories because of confession. They want people to hear their confession.
Oh, I can't help it. You know, people would have to pay me to be quiet, and then I probably couldn't.
You know, they want to be forgiven.
My notion is that for those who have suffered trauma, that storytelling is a way of forgetting.
Why do people tell stories?
I think people tell stories. For instance, I'm a reader from way back, and I like 19th century literature, particularly like Dickens, where, you know, it's the time when stories were everything. And in fact, telling stories in parlors was the entertainment.
We tell narratives for entertainment, but the fact that stories entertain implies that there's something, a deeper need.
There's a little bit of just a human need to be remembered. I was here. I am me. I'm a human being, and I was here, and I have a story to tell. I'm from this place, and I lived on this mountain, and that mountain's name was Snowbird Mountain, and it got its name because, and then the story.
Those stories are about the most important commodity we have among us to trade. They're what make your friends. They make communities out of strangers. They grow roots in a place. I mean, those swapping of stories. Now, I mean, another way to do it is common experience. But we don't live commonly anymore. I mean, we really don't do that much with other people. We hang out in our single family dwellings and deal like that. So those stories, those real stories, are the way to make experience common.
Storytelling is really about experience rather than information. And both in the telling and in the listening, there's a lot going on that has to do with claiming experience, almost as if we need to tell our experience in order to really claim it.
The Hasidic tradition is very, very clear about that. There are all sorts of wonderful sayings and aphorisms. For example, the Bratslaver, Reb Nachman, who was one of the great founders of Hasidic storytelling, said, "When I speak to my fellows, there goes out a simple light and a returning light. My words have no clothes," which is this wonderful evocation of both the nakedness and the intimacy when one person talks to another, and the reciprocity of it. There's something of word magic in the storytelling.
All you have to do, if you grew up in this, is kind of close your eyes and you can literally hear again the sound of somebody's voice rising and falling on the night air telling those old stories.
I was a little bashful, lean, so, but it went on, and a witch over here on Stone Mountain fixed me. That's the reason I'm the way I am. A witch fixed me over here on that mountain of Pulling Galak. She said, "I'm a putting a little spell on you," said, "You kind of shy," and said, "I'm going to fix you where you'd talk to the president."
Well, look at Reagan. Reagan is a great storyteller.
I once heard a guy, A.A. Allen, he's now dead. Oh, man, he was the best.
I know there are a lot of stories that came out of the Robertson family, the tinkers, the traveling people.
Tammy Baker on PTL Club is the finest female storyteller in the country.
You listen to Lee Iacocca on television, you say, "My God, there's a storyteller. I mean, he can tell a story." People are natural storytellers. I think people love to hear about other people's experiences. I think whenever somebody says, "I got to tell you what happened to me yesterday," everybody's ears perk up, you know? You go in the teacher's lounge and say, "I got to tell you what just happened." And people are in the middle of 20 different conversations, and it's like if somebody said, "When E.F. Hutton talks, everybody listens," you know? That's exactly what happens. It's like it's exactly the same thing when somebody comes in with an envelope full of photographs from the Kodak store, you know? Everybody got a chance to look at the pictures, and they're all stupid. You know, they're all pictures of Grandma so-and-so standing in front of a sign that says, "Welcome to Yosemite." But everybody wants to look at every one. You know, I don't know why that is. I mean, it's some kind of a human thing, you know. Telling stories, constructing a narrative is making a sense out of what otherwise would be the buzzing, blooming confusion of random events.
Any art form, after all, one of its major functions is to shape order out of a seemingly chaotic environment, and storytelling is no exception.
I once precipitated a real, almost First Amendment debate on the bus going to work once, with people coming to blows and real soapbox arguments, because I told someone to turn down their Walkman, because it was, you know, it sounds like a mosquito in your ear, that awful sound. I suppose my ears are a little too sensitive, but it was like, and you only hear that, and then you hear the, you know, and I told somebody to turn it down, and, you know, naturally, of course, he said, "What?" four times, and finally I said, you know, I pointed, and he took it off, and he said, "What?" And I said, "Turn that down, it's too loud." And of course, he said to me, "Well, I've got my earphones on." I said, "Well, you don't understand what it sounds like, you know." And then all of a sudden, everybody on the back of this bus started saying, "Yeah, tell him, you know, he has no right to all those things that drive you crazy." And somebody else said, "Well, he's got his earphones on, and it spread, and finally I had to get off the bus. It was still going on."
People walk around telling stories to themselves, even when they're not even conscious of it. For example, like if you're mad at somebody, you fantasize having it out with them. And so these lines just go through your mind. You said this, and I said that, and you did this, and I did that, and it's a story.
This one happened in the emergency room of Johnson City's Memorial Hospital on a Saturday night. A friend of mine had fallen and cut the back of his head. He was 13 or so at the time, and mine was the only car in the parking lot, and his dad and I packed him into the car and rushed him down to the emergency room, and he and his dad were back in the emergency room part of it getting the head sewed up, and I was waiting in the waiting room of the emergency room. And sitting next to me was this lady who passed out every other minute or so. And next to her was a woman, her friend, who would, shake her, slap her really gently or whatever, and she'd come around again and they'd continue the conversation. Now, it seemed to me like she ought to be back in the emergency room, but she's not. She's not even waiting to get in. She's waiting for somebody who's back there, okay? And the two of them are sitting here and they're doing one thing and the other. And then in the door of the emergency room came these three people, and they were dressed up in disco clothes and high heels. I mean, the whole kit and caboodle. And they'd had a drink or two, and they were sliding in the emergency room, by the emergency room, to see who they knew was there. I mean, on Saturday night, you never know who's going to show up. Well, they knew this woman sitting next to me, so the three of them came around. And they sat down in the three chairs directly opposite the three of us. And there were two women and a man. And the two women sat in front of these two women, and the man sat in front of me. And he had a good eye, and he had a wall eye. And the bad eye, well, the good eye looked at the women, and the bad eye looked at me. So I felt kind of included in this whole conversation. Law, you know who's living down in Jack's old house? And Jack and his family moved down where George used to live before he moved out to the country. Well, now, George broke his leg, and he come back, and he moved in with his cousins right next door to where I used to live when y'all had the house across the street. Richie's lived there now where you lived. Well, the people who lived on the other side, they moved in after you left, I think. They live in my old house now. It has more yard. Well, anyway, that house next door, the one Lucy moved out of into Jack's old place, well, George ain't getting along too good with his cousins right now, and he's thinking about moving in.
When my husband introduced me to his uncle when he came to New York, and we got to talking, that my uncle's wife's sister married my daddy's cousin's son that my daddy helped to become a doctor.
Well, I guess one of the great storytellers of all time would be Charles Dickens.
So was Ruth McHenry Stewart.
He was popular as a rock star when he came to America.
People like Jimmy Breslin and Mike Royko and...
We were talking about Tommy Bledsoe a moment ago. I think he's a real storyteller. And he's got him by the pound.
Well, my father was very much of a storyteller.
I have an uncle whose name is Leroy.
There are kids that are good storytellers. There are kids that are great storytellers.
But then there's this barn of chickens that go flopping and over the field.
I think I found the whole reason for storytelling through having him and keeping him. But just to explain, it's real easy to explain the world to him through stories. And I left him with this woman who's just got this phobia against lightning and thunder, which I don't have any problems with at all. But it was thundering yesterday, and he was absolutely scared to death. And that's where he learned fear. So I was telling him, I just let it go, I just let him go because I couldn't think of anything. And then I just said, oh, it's just the clouds laughing. They're bumping into each other and they get embarrassed and they laugh, it's just like the moment I said it, peace came all over him. It was all it took.
My dad would lie in bed with us, with my brother and I. My brother and I, one on each side, right? And he would open the book, and he would pretend like he was reading the book, but it was not Burr Bear and Burr Fox and Burr Rabbit. It was Burr Joe and Burr Skip and Burr Pierce and Reeve, okay? And Burr anything else that was troubling either one of us at the time. I didn't know the real story of Burr Rabbit and the Tar Baby until I read it for myself, okay? Because I thought Burr Rabbit was Joe and the Tar Baby was my math teacher for years, okay?
Sometimes you can take a story and make it up and let it fit a child the way you want it to grow up, and sometimes it'll work.
I remember when my grandmother didn't want me to do things. There's Kojo's Caverns over in Bell County, Kentucky. It's like these deep caverns you go underneath and you do this big tour. And my grandmother thought it was really dangerous, so she made up this story about this girl being in there with her boyfriend and them turning off the lights, and she kept thinking he was pinching her, and a rattlesnake bit her 15 times. And of course I didn't want to go to Kojo's Caverns after that, you know? It's like, it's a way of warning and protecting, too. It's, you know, some stories of warning and protecting you that you shouldn't do that.
These stories gave children the values of life, the cautionary things of life, the taboos of life. Sometimes they didn't understand it until they were quite grown up, like I did. You know, I tell one story about Burr Possum and Burr Snake, and it has happened to me many times. Looking at that individual, I knew he was a con artist, but I took him in anyway, and he took me. You understand what I'm saying? And then in the story of Burr Possum and Burr Snake says, oh, just put me in your pocket, I'll be real quiet. And then Burr Possum does, and a few minutes later he says, I'm gonna bite you. And Burr Possum says, but you can't. I took you in. Burr Snake said, well, you know that was a snake when you took me in. You knew I was going to bite you. You knew what I was capable of doing. Your moral, don't trouble trouble till trouble troubles you, you know?
My favorite storyteller is...
Back home, and you know, there's some great storytellers.
I used to have a big, long list of them, you know, written on.
Maybe Spielberg and E.T.
Goggles McCoy.
My grandfather and Mr. Flowers.
Chase. Richard Chase.
Taylor Crockett in Macon County, North Carolina. That's a big bear hunter, and he's got lots of stories, good stories.
Granny Stewart, who's this old woman in Artemis where I grew up, that was blind in one eye and could barely hear. But we'd all go up and visit Granny when we were growing up, and she didn't have electric heat in her house. She had a big fireplace, and she'd dip snuff, and she'd spit, and I swear that woman could spit 5 feet.
This is New York City, ladies and gentlemen. Traveling Jewish theater checks into the Gramercy Park Hotel. Put our sax and guitar in the hotel room. Go out to eat. Come back. They're gone. Stolen out of the hotel. Boom. We found a guitar that was pretty easy, but had to rent a saxophone. And literally the last day, the day of the show, I was going down to get the sax after finding it at all these stores on 42nd. And I had my Cubs hat on. And there was one last place I hadn't checked, and I went in there, and I went in. I said, I'd like to rent an alto. And in typical New York fashion, he said, what are you talking about? So I said, I want to rent an alto. He says, what for? I said, well, it was stolen out of my hotel room. He says, stolen out of your hotel room? I said, yeah, an alto and a guitar. He said, who are you with? I said, a traveling Jewish theater. He said, how much you pay to get it back? I said, 200. He said, how much for the guitar? I said, another 200. He said, just a minute. He went downstairs. About 5-7 minutes later, he came up. He said, they're in. So, the next day, I brought back our guitar and saxophone for $400.
Don, this is, I'll think of his name, this is somebody you need to go find. He's in Charlotte, North Carolina. great storyteller.
There was a guy in Virginia, Kentucky. I don't know, he may have died.
Freddie Bradley, or Fred Bradley. The last that I knew of him.
Cornbread Red, Earl the Squirrel, they two great.
Hemroy and Harry.
Curtis Blow.
You know, Whoopi Goldberg.
Polly Branham Johnson. Henry Miller. Henry Miller is one of my favorite writers because he's just a born storyteller. And when you read his books, it's as if somebody's on a bar stool next to you telling you a story. And he, in Tropic of Capricorn, which I think is his best book, he quotes from Peter Abelard. The quote is, paraphrasing, I tell you these things, and this is another reason why people tell stories, I think. I tell you these things so that upon hearing it, you who also suffer from these things, as I know you do, will know that you're not alone. You know, I think that people who do this have a certain desire to help other people.
But one of the reasons psychiatry is so successful today and so necessary is that we are not accustomed to listening to one another's troubles, which is part of what stories are. And you have to tell those stories. You have to tell them to work through them. And if you have to pay somebody to do it, then to listen to your stories, that's sort of a sad state in this world. But better to pay somebody than not to tell them, because in the telling of them, you work through them.
I think at a real primitive level, that's what storytelling is. It's like if you're stuck with some sadness or anger or something like that, you can tell a story about it, and that feeling has a way of leaving you and going to somebody else, the way that you share a lot of emotions, and storytelling is like a mode for doing that.
Insofar as people have to deal with suffering and revalue their own worth from inside rather than outside, if they're a disdained group, if they're an oppressed group, you're going to have stories that have to do with the meaning of their suffering. And some notion of keeping the stories alive as a responsibility, as the burden of those who are there. That is the bearing witness theme.
I am from Berlin, Germany. And in 1937, I had a letter from the police department that I'm losing my citizenship. From now on, I'm going to be, instead of Lottie, I'm going to be Sarah. And that I'm going to have to leave the country within 6 weeks, or I will be put into the concentration camp.
You know when somebody's in an airplane and the pilots just died, and the person in the back can't drive the plane. They get up in the control and the person on the ground talks them through. The storyteller has played that part through the ages of talking a people through oppression. Because your imagination takes over at a point when you are so oppressed, you can become the person who outwits the oppressor. Brer Rabbit could outsmart Brer Fox and Brer Bear. Brer Bear and Brer Fox were the master, the patty rollers, the people who oppressed the black man. Brer Rabbit was the slave.
American Indians have the same hero, the Roadrunner and the Coyote. If you don't have strength, if you're a minority culture, then you have to hope that you can succeed with your wits. That's the only hope you have. So a young Cajun boy goes to Harvard, and he's trying to find his way around. So he stops someone on the street and says, excuse me, where's the library at? And the person says in a very proper northeastern accent, you must not be from here. One never ends a question with a preposition. And he said, oh, excuse me, where's the library at, asshole? That's a sign, this joke popped up about 3 years ago, that's a sign of a culture that is striking back. That says, wait a minute, I don't buy
your assessment of me anymore. I think that jokes and stories in general are often funny, but they're often very, very serious.
The story that I like so much, one day Brer Rabbit was enjoying himself at his place at the well. And Brer Fox walks up and grabbed him by the ears and he said, I got you now. I'm going to take you home. I'm going to snatch them ears out, cut off that tail, cut off your legs, skin you and eat you. Brer Rabbit said, oh, Brer Fox. He said, why did you come along now? He said, I was just getting ready to get in the well and get me a piece of cheese. Brer Fox said, cheese? Brer Fox said, is there cheese in the well? Brer Rabbit said, yeah, big old yellow piece of cheese. Brer Fox said, I like cheese. Brer Rabbit said, I know it. He said, now I'll tell you what, I'm going to give you a piece of it when I get it. If you just turn me loose, I will get it and I will divide it. Brer Fox said, can I see it? Brer Rabbit said, yeah, just walk right over there and look. Well, when Brer Fox looked in the well, he saw this great big old yellow ball. Well, it was the moon shining down into the well, but he didn't know it. Brer Fox said, I believe that's the biggest piece of cheese I have ever seen in my life. Brer Rabbit said, well, I'm going to get it. I'm just going to get right here in this bucket, and you can see me. See, I can't get out. He said, I'm going to go down there and get it. Brer Fox said, all right. So Brer Rabbit leaped into the bucket, and the bucket went down. As that bucket was going down, the other bucket was coming up. So Brer Fox was listening, and Brer Rabbit was saying, Brer Fox said, what's the matter? What's the matter? Brer Rabbit said, it's bigger than I thought it was going to be. He said, I can't even lift it. Brer Fox said, can I help you? Oh, Brer Rabbit said, yes. Get in the other bucket and come on down here. Well, Brer Fox never hesitated. He leaped up in the bucket, and as that bucket was going down, Brer Rabbit's bucket was coming up. And when they passed one another, Brer Rabbit said, I fooled you again. And when the bucket went down, Brer Rabbit got out and leaped on and went on to the broad patch where he belonged. Now, tomorrow, when I've got to go out in a hot field and pick cotton, whole cotton, pick tomatoes or do whatever it was I had to do, I could sort of think about that as I walk through that and laugh about it, thinking I'm going to overcome this one day. And you may never be able to overcome it, but you got another piece of strength to work on. The storytellers talk them through the oppression.
Word of Mouth was written and produced by George King for WRFG-FM, Atlanta, Georgia. Today you heard in order of appearance actors Corey Fisher and Albert Greenberg, author-broadcaster Studs Terkel, performance artist Mike Fader, musician Tommy Thompson, legend teller Catherine Smith, writer Joe Carson, anthropologist Barbara Meyerhoff, folklorist Charlotte Ross, storyteller Ray Hicks, educator Elliot Wigginton, homemaker Lottie Lerner, actress Angeline DeBoard, homemaker Florida Sloan, folklorist Debbie Bays, storyteller Jackie Torrance, and folklorist Barry Ancelet. Funding for this series was provided by the Humanities Council's Endowments and Committees of Georgia, Alabama, Kentucky, Louisiana, Mississippi, South Carolina, and Tennessee. With additional funding from the City of Atlanta's Bureau of Cultural Affairs and the Georgia Council for the Arts. The principal humanities consultant for the series was Cliff Kuhn. Production assistant, Louise Bloom. I'm Walt Elder. Next week, Word of Mouth focuses on the South, tracing the role narratives play in our families and communities, and asking, are we losing our stories?
Why do people tell stories? Do they tell as many today? That's the thing, that's the big question.
There's a wonderful story that Corey Fisher tells about the need to tell stories. It's about the Baal Shem Tov, who was the founder of Hasidic Judaism.
During the Baal Shem Tov's life, whenever the community was threatened by a pogrom or a disaster, he would go into a special place in the forest that only he knew about. He would kindle a fire and say a special prayer, a very secret prayer, and that would work to avert the catastrophe. Now his successor, the next rabbi in the line, no longer knew where that place in the forest was, but he still knew the prayer and could light the fire, and that was enough, that was sufficient to avert the catastrophe. Now his successor had lost the prayer, so all he could do was kindle a fire, and that still was sufficient. And now in our time, we can no longer even kindle the fire, nor can we say the prayer, and we don't know where the place in the forest is. So all we can do is tell the story, and that has to be sufficient.